thanks so much for joining us again this week. This week, we do not have a special guest with us, so Alan and I are going to be talking in depth about a really important topic that we have discussed pretty frequently throughout the last 20 or so episodes, but we haven't really gotten into the nitty-gritty of things and kind of how it works out in real life. And we've done a couple of these episodes in the past where we talk more tactically about kind of the tools and the processes that go into this experience of finding your purpose. And we really want to make sure that we're matching the tactical with kind of the aspirational and the inspirational stories that we're sharing with our guests each week. And the reason for that is that we are so inspired and so thankful that we have so many incredible guests that have come on and told their stories. And usually we kind of focus on their process, but we don't dig into each element of that process. And there's a lot of common threads in between the stories that we're hearing. And so we want to make sure that we're taking the time to really dive deep into what those things are and how you as an individual, you as the listener, can really implement some of these tools in your life. And so this week, we're going to talk about trust networks, which is something that we talk about a lot. And it's something that I think is inherently understandable. But when you think about building trust networks, it's something that could seem really intimidating. And so we're going to dive deep into that today. So Alan, let's get started and talk about just how would you define a trust network and what is the value of a trust network?
Thanks, Danielle. This actually brings me back a little bit to the work I did at Stanford, where I started interacting with some of the students there. And what I started to learn was there was a sense where you could come into a conversation with many of them as your true self. And this is basically sharing vulnerability. They accept you unconditionally when you walk into the discussion, and they're non-judgmental with how they engage you. And it builds off of some elements of trust as I use it when we teach interpersonal dynamics based off of a book that we use by Charles Feltman called The Thin Book of Trust. And it comes in with four elements where the other party shows care, reliability, sincerity, and competence. Those are how he characterizes what trust means. And all of those have to be part of the relationship in order to engage it. And the reason why I think this is important is because I've had prior students say, hey, I'm going to go network, but they don't understand why they're networking. They don't understand with whom they're going to try to target. And in many cases, those networks are shallow and they can't really offer useful insights because the relationship is sort of kept at that shallow level and you can't really get real feedback that fits you. You're getting sort of filtered feedback from a different perspective.
I think that's something really important to mention from the start is kind of networking as a topic of like networking events versus building a trust network. Those are two entirely different things to me. And I feel like I have a really great trust network. I have a lot of people in my life that I can rely on and that, you know, can help me both personally and professionally. And I hate networking events. I despise networking events. I think that they are so inauthentic. And I think it's really hard, to the credit of career centers and organizations, whoever's putting on an event like that, it's really hard to have an event like that where the idea is just to quote unquote network, to really make it feel like it's authentic and meaningful when the whole purpose of it is to try and gain something from someone else, essentially. And so I think that's a really important distinction that you just made, because I'm wondering if, as people are listening to us talking about this, if that's what they had in mind, was like building your trust network. Go out and go to networking events and talk to recruiters at a table, and that's your trust network. Like, that is not what we're talking about. And I think that's a really important distinction.
I think it's important to characterize that in my mind, there are very few people in my trust network. And these are the people I can always go to for real talk. This is where I share my anxieties. This is where I hear real feedback. These are people with whom I trust entirely so that I can kind of keep my baggage in that space so that I can get the professional image out beyond that. And so this is where you can kind of do, if we will, experimentation and thinking creatively, because I know it stays within that group. And so trust networks to me are pretty small. They're pretty contained. And as I said earlier, I think it's incredibly important to get this concept through that those people are accepting unconditionally. You don't have to fit some sort of model, or you don't have to do some work in order to be accepted by them. They accept you regardless of how you come into the engagement. And that's pretty rare to find.
Yeah. So that's kind of the question I have is, how do you know when someone is one of those people for you? And how do you start building that if you feel like you don't have that already? I think that's something, especially early on in my career, I can think back to kind of who I was looking to for feedback. And I think usually when we are earlier on in life or just in our career, you know, our trust networks are usually family and parents and, you know, maybe siblings, friends, whoever it is. But that might not always be the best people to look to, particularly for career advice. And so that's a question I have for you, Alan, is how have you identified which people to trust in that network for you and how have you built it?
So that's a great question. And actually, I would say that one has to be careful to assume that family and friends are in fact in the trust network. Many of the people with whom we actually interact have conditional expectations upon us and we can't really trust them. And that's really important to think about, that you can't assume that people in that network really understand you. But to answer your other question, there's a great book from Carol Robin. Carol ran the interpersonal dynamics course at Stanford and was the Stanford MBA award-winning teacher several years ago. And she wrote a book with her colleague called Connect. And in that book, they talk about sharing vulnerability, which is one of the core, in my mind, it's a necessary condition to sense that you are building trust. And they talk about experimenting where you walk into a scenario with somebody and you kind of give a little bit. There are things that you are typically unwilling to share with other people because it makes you feel vulnerable. But what you can do is you can do trial runs with a little bit of information to see whether they meet you there and share a little bit back. And so there's this incremental growth on vulnerability sharing. And when you start realizing that it's a safe space, that's when you start sensing that you probably do have a trust network. And if you're met with these little increments of vulnerability, then that allows you to explore even more vulnerable spaces. And what you'll find is that this is a growth thing over time. And sometimes the time is short and compressed, and you can immediately immerse yourself with somebody with shared vulnerability early, quickly, because they're comfortable with themselves and they're happy to share vulnerability. I think Brianna is a classic example of that, where she was very open to sharing vulnerability. And I think at least I sensed trust right away with that conversation, or the ability to develop trust with that. In other cases, it takes a little bit longer. And what we're also looking for is that trust ever violated? In other words, if I've shared some vulnerability, is that it's somehow accidentally or intentionally spilled out to others? And does it sort of hurt me later that I've shared that? That's part of it. And again, I would recommend some people look at that book, Connect, Carol Robin and David Bradford from Stanford, who've written that book. That's a pretty good resource for that.
Yeah, I think those are some great points. But I think more specifically too, if someone's listening to this episode and they're like, that's all fine and great, but if I don't even have anyone to start talking about those vulnerabilities with, where do I start? And I think this is two separate issues if you're thinking about your professional life and your personal life. So for the purposes of today's conversation, I think we should focus on the professional, but I do think that this applies as well to personal relationships. But one of the things that I have strategically done over the last, I don't know, probably 5 to 8 years is LinkedIn as a tool for actually finding authentic connections. And we had gotten some feedback, I think it was from someone who was a connection to Mikey about the podcast. And they essentially asked Mikey, they said, well, how do you reach out to people? How do you create these connections? If one, you're an introvert, or two, you just don't know how to reach out. And so we'll talk about introversion and extroversion in a second, but to reach out in general to anyone, regardless of if you're an introvert or an extrovert, something that I've done over the last 5 to 7 years is use LinkedIn as this resource where I can connect with people and foster really amazing communities from literally scratch. And so what I mean by that is not just like spamming everyone on LinkedIn and, you know, going on and finding people who don't have anything to connect with me on. But I use LinkedIn very strategically to find people who either have careers that I admire, they have skills that I want to obtain, or they have any kind of experience that I'm looking to grow into in the future. And so I really use LinkedIn in that way, and I use keywords. So for myself, as I've kind of discussed in the past, my goal is ultimately to be in the women's rights advocacy space. And what that has meant has changed over time. But I have used LinkedIn throughout the years to find other people who are doing that work. And I myself don't really like to reach out cold to people because it feels really intimidating and scary. But when you have a tool like LinkedIn and you can find really amazing people who are doing jobs that you would like to see yourself in someday, it's really easy and quick to do a quick keyword search for like women's rights advocate in my case, and to find people across the world who are doing that work and to look through their resume and to say, oh, I really want to have a conversation with them. And so what I do after that is I'll save their LinkedIn profile. Usually like I'll do like a download or a print of their profile, because that can help with resume building, that can help with looking for jobs with similar skill sets, everything like that. But then I also send them a message and I say, hey, person, my name is Danielle. I am a second year law student at the University of Colorado. I am interested in X. I saw in your profile that you have X experience. Would you be willing to talk to me for 15 minutes? Send. And that's it. And usually, I'd say probably 95% of the time, people that you have never met in your whole life will respond and say, yes, I would love to talk to you about that. Because you have done exactly what you were just saying, Alan, which is establish a connection on a mutually interesting point. And you've started to have a conversation that involves some kind of vulnerability. And that's paid off dividends in my career, because I've met so many incredible people who we have intersecting interests. And it all started from I think I have 150 characters or something to send to someone over LinkedIn. 150 characters is all you need.
If I may, let me unpack why that's worked for you and how it can completely backfire for other people.
Perfect.
I want to be very careful for the audience that they recognize and understand that there is a particular way to make this work, the way Danielle has described it. And then there's most of the way that it can backfire. The key here is what you've been able to do is legitimately articulate a trust relationship could be formed, and we'll unpack that specifically in a moment. The one thing that you have to recognize, all of you, if you're going to approach this, which I think is completely doable, and you and I have discussed this for years, why it works, is that you have to understand the other people you're reaching out to are ridiculously busy, and they will default to, who are you? I don't have time. So the default is they do not trust these requests. That is their default. And quite frankly, you're going to be the same way when you're on the other side of these requests. So how does one flip that? And you kind of went into some discussions that actually break down. Again, if we go to Feltman's four characteristics of trust, one of them is competence. And so the way you're going into competence is you're basically targeting specific people who are like in your area. And you've also mentioned that you have done some work in that area. And it doesn't have to be a degree that you're doing. Like, your law school definitely helps with the competence piece, but also it could be an immersive piece. So I did a month volunteering at place X, so I understand a little bit about what you're dealing with. There has to be a way in which you can indicate your competence. Then the care piece and the sincerity piece. So the sincerity piece is also indicated by the fact that you care about this project enough to reach out and that you've already done some work in the area on your own. So that's also part of the care and sincerity piece. The reliability piece and also the care and sincerity shows up by the fact that you're only asking for 15 minutes. That is a critical, critical piece. Remember, the reader is always too busy to engage you. And so it's much easier to say, look, I just need 15 minutes to ask one question. Now, the good news is that if the relationship sparks, then they'll probably give you 60 minutes for that 15 because they'll enjoy talking to you. But the initial ask has to be very, very short. You have to have it, as you said, within 150 characters. You have to be extremely, extremely cognizant that you're asking for them to commit time without ever knowing who you are. And so all four elements of trust have to be in that 150 words, care, reliability, sincerity, and competence. That's how that works. And that's why you've been successful with it.
Yeah. And I think tactically on the reliability piece is once someone says yes to you, that's huge. And so you have to follow that up immediately with a plan, a calendar invite. As soon as you get someone to respond to you, if you are successful in that, sometimes people have said, hey, thank you for reaching out. Could you explain more about what specifically you would like to talk to me about? So they're gatekeeping their time, which I completely respect. And once you get the invite, though, to talk to someone on the phone, over Zoom, over real life coffee, you have to follow up. You have to send an email beforehand that says, hey, are we still on for this time tomorrow? Send a thank you email afterwards. Like those little things matter because then you become a person that, yeah, you might have been a stranger on the internet before, but after that conversation, they would be willing to give you more time in the future. And that's how you really start to build out these networks. For a quick example, I did this literally last week. I had a conversation with an attorney who was doing women's rights work in New York, and I reached out to her a few months ago. She got back to me and we set up time, ended up having to move a couple of times, but very much stayed on top of it, was in direct communication with her and said, you know, I'd really just love a quick conversation if it's still available to you. And we ended up having a 45-minute conversation off of the 15 that I asked for just because we were having a really great time. She asked me a lot of questions about myself. I had a list of questions prepared about her. And so it matters a lot what you do in that pre-work stage to how well your conversation will go in the moment. And then if anything will happen on the flip side of that.
I want to add too, you can only ask for information. You cannot put out any feeler that you're asking for anything beyond that. Donations, a job, anything that actually requires them to step forward and do anything beyond just tell you about what they're doing is outside the bounds, and it will violate, it will trigger them to not trust you even more, and it will shut down doors. That has to happen organically because they don't know you. And so they're not going to step out and help you with a job placement or an internship or any of that until you've developed trust. And so the very first thing is simply, can I learn about what you're doing? That's it. That's where I recommend you start. And to your point, as far as your plan goes, when I mentor people like you or students, I say, you need to know very specifically what are the first two questions you're asking. And you need to send that to them. And they have to be very precisely written.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the other thing too is even if you're having a conversation with someone and it's going well, don't go over time and just assume that they're okay going over time. If I'm talking to someone and I've said 15 minutes, I will be sure at the 15-minute mark to say, hey, I would just like to be cognizant of your time. I'm happy to keep talking, but I really want to respect your time so that they know that I am not going to keep pushing their time limits. And again, that just says, hey, I care about this. I care about the time that you're giving me and just being really respectful. But I think the part about not asking for anything except for talking about their experience is critical. I get messages now on LinkedIn, and I especially was before law school when I worked at Nike, for example, a huge brand that people want to work for. And I had tons of people messaging me about, can you get me a job at Nike? Like people I had never met in my life were sending me messages that were just very strange, but also were like, absolutely not. I have no idea who you are. I don't even know if you're real, all of those things. And so you can't ask for that. You can only ask for them to share their experience and stick to that. And if something comes of it, great. But otherwise, you're gaining knowledge. And that's the important part.
This is a good opportunity also to say and call it out specifically. One of the things that actually helps with developing this kind of trust relationship is utilizing what we call in social science this concept of self-selection. And Danielle, you've heard me use that term over and over and over again. So now's the time to introduce it. Do you want to describe what that is, or do you want me to?
I love self-selection. I'd love to hear your actual definition of it because I feel like I just inherently know what it is now.
So self-selection is this concept where we choose, based on our innate interests, we choose paths, and often we choose paths and things that we do regularly that we don't really pay attention to. So some people inherently just select to go into nature, or some people like going into nightclubs and things like that. Like we inherently do things naturally, and that's where our emotional interests lie. And when we do that, then we meet people who are like-minded there. And it sounds cliche, but we find compatibility indicators when we match on these types of characteristics. And so looking for ways to identify people who will emotionally resonate with your interests is pretty straightforward. And in LinkedIn, here's an example. We had Phoebe, if you think about it, when I was working with Phoebe Kluck, who we interviewed earlier, at that time, very interested in refugee work and particularly with younger women. And we were looking on LinkedIn for people who are currently working on refugee projects for young women. And right there, emotional connection would almost be guaranteed because they're selecting, they're both choosing to engage in this work, which is emotional commitment to this project. And so when you consider the fact that somebody who's been working on a refugee project for 15 years must clearly care a lot about it and probably doesn't meet too many other people outside of work who really want to engage in a conversation around it, then all of a sudden you get some younger person who's passionate about it coming up and saying, hey, can I learn more about it? Then they're probably excited to talk to that younger person. And it's a lot easier to try to build that relationship that way.
I think that's a really important point. And I think this is a great place to discuss something that we also wanted to make sure that we talked about today was how this process might be similar or different for people who would define themselves as introverts or extroverts. And this was another piece of feedback that we got from a listener that they themselves were an introvert. And so the idea that they had to go out and try and make these connections with people that they didn't know felt really uncomfortable and felt really just like something that they didn't want to do. And so very discouraged by that idea. And so I have two definitions here that I wanted to share that are from Psychology Today, which Psychology Today is not like a rigorous academic paper, all fair warnings, but I think it's a quick, good definition of what these two things mean. So an extrovert is a person that has personality traits typically characterized by outgoingness, high energy, and/or talkativeness. In general, the term refers to a state of being where someone recharges or draws energy from being with other people. Whereas an introvert is a personality style characterized by a preference for the inner life of the mind over the outer world of other people. Introverts do not fear or dislike others. They are neither shy nor plagued by loneliness. I liked that sentence. That was funny. A crowded cocktail party may be torture for introverts, but they enjoy one-on-one engagement in calm environments, which is much more suited to the makeup of their nervous system. So I don't know how much I agree with every single word in those definitions, but I would define myself as an introvert. I think I am an introvert that can play an extrovert is what I like to say sometimes, that depending on the situation, I can seem very talkative and high energy and outgoing, but I actually really need time to recharge. And it depends on the environment in which I can actually get energy from a group or not. And we had a team conversation about this. I think it was last week or the week before. And what was hysterical was Mikey, Jack, and I all have the same Myers-Briggs four letters as each other. So I am an ENFJ or INFJ, depending on when I take the test. So it's I flip between the extrovert and the introvert. Jack is an INFJ and Mikey is an ENFJ. And so we're all in the same boat of similar personality types, I guess. And so we were kind of talking about this issue of all of us really strongly identify with that principle of introversion, of like not feeling comfortable in large crowds or like feeling like I'm getting energy from a large group of people that I don't know or like meeting someone new. And so how could we talk about how we as this podcast, this group that we work with, this team has approached building trust with each other, but also with our careers and things as being introverts. And so that's one thing that we wanted to touch on today. But Alan, I know that you have defined yourself as an introvert in the past. What is this process of building trust and establishing these networks? What has it felt like for you if you're someone that doesn't identify as wanting to just constantly be around other people?
So I'm not a psychologist. You are trained more than I am on it. But my understanding is that there's a whole, everybody's on a spectrum on that. And also that there's this thing called social introversion, et cetera. But what I think is important is to suggest that many introverts are, in fact, very people-oriented. It's just an energy thing. And also, it's the kind of engagement that they like. So introverts really only like trust engagements. So they tend to like the deep conversations, the ones where they can share vulnerability, the ones that are quieter over wine and dinner and something like that, instead of the party scene, which is often associated with more shallow discussion. That's a little bit too black and white on that. But one of the things I find interesting about the conversation that you just had was, to me, illustrative potentially of self-selection. So the fact that you met people who are like you in some dimensions in a format like this is indicative of who tends to want to get involved with a project like this. And so that's one of the potential inferences from that fact. So people who are interested in talking about things like unconditional acceptance and shared vulnerability might in fact be searching for those kinds of relationships. Now, to the original question of how does one approach a cold call for somebody, if in fact I tend to be a little bit reserved in how I engage this, I feel uncomfortable asking somebody I don't know. And I think one of the things to consider is the fact that, or the potential that that person is probably more like you than you think if you've done your self-selection properly. So if it's a project where you're reaching out to somebody working on something that's deeply empathic, so maybe it's, again, working on refugee work or working with at-risk youth or social work or something like that, then the probability is that that person at least shares empathy and possibly is also an introvert. And so the ability to connect there is probably quite high, particularly if you start doing some of the work that we had discussed about how to approach them.
I think that that's really true. And that's something that I have focused on a lot because I have social anxiety. I get really anxious around people in general, both people that I know and people that I don't. And that's something that, you know, I work through every day. But I think particularly with situations where you're trying to meet new people, regardless if you have social anxiety or not, it can be really hard. And so something that I've focused on, you know, throughout, either if it's sending the cold LinkedIn messages or meeting people in real life, is focusing on that common ground and really sticking to that mutual interest that you know that you have. And so when I do reach out to someone and we have a shared interest in whether it's some kind of women's rights advocacy or dogs or something, you know, there's actually lots of things that people can connect on. And so even if it's something as simple as I have a couple of really amazing neighbors in my neighborhood, and we've all gotten together and had drinks a couple of times, and something like that would usually give me a lot of anxiety. But something that we all really enjoy doing is being outside and focusing on kind of like giving back to the earth and like recycling and I don't know, all of that stuff. And so we focused a lot in our early conversations on those, I'd call them like safe topics almost, like something that makes me work through that anxiety by just focusing on something that I have that common ground with that person with. And then you can go from there and it becomes less hard because you feel like you have that foundation for a relationship with them. And it's literally one step at a time. You can't run until you've walked. So that's kind of my own personal approach to it, but that's how I do it.
That's a great segue to some of the research one of my colleagues at Stanford used to write about, which is the fact that apparently the psychology literature suggests that we don't need much in common to bond. And you see this whenever you're in stranger relationships. So you talked about like that professional networking thing where you hate it. There's a room full of people. They're all in their business suits. It's extremely awkward, especially if you're introverted. You hate that environment. But the research suggests that if you have anything in common, anything, even a birthday, then all of a sudden it's an opportunity for you to kind of relax a little bit. And you can imagine all of us have had this experience where if I know somebody in common, it relaxes us. Or if you're from the same hometown, it relaxes you because you find anything to link together. And so what I've encouraged and what I actually started practicing was every time I walk into those professional environments where I know I'm going to be incredibly uncomfortable, I try to study, if I can, who's in the room before I get in the room. And I look to see if there's anything I can talk about that we share in common. And so then I'll approach, instead of saying I'm going to walk into this room full of 100 people, I'm now thinking in terms of 5. And I'm targeting those 5 because I've already done some research on them. This is where LinkedIn could be one of the avenues where I do research. And I say, hey, I hear you're from X. That's interesting to me. Or I'm from there too, or something like that. You try to build that connection first. that relaxes you, that gets you into sort of a more human discussion. And then you can see where, and I call it surfing the conversation at that point, then you can kind of ride the conversation and see if it happens organically. So that breaks down the space and makes it more manageable. And it also transfers some control rights to me about how I'm going to engage the room instead of me walking in the room sort of sheepishly. And one of the things you'll notice too in these social gatherings are the introverts have the tendency to be on the perimeter and they're having the private conversations one-to-one.
Me, every time I go to any kind of party is what you've just described.
Exactly. And so this gives you an opportunity to at least recognize that's how it's going to happen and to plan that and to exploit that.
Yeah. And you don't mean exploit in like a manipulative way. What you mean is exploit in the sense of to get something out of that experience that is meaningful to you. And I think that's really important.
If I can walk into a room full of 100 strangers and make any connection with two or three, that's a big win.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's a great place to kind of wrap up today. And this is a topic that this isn't the last time we'll talk about trust networks. And it's something that I think evolves as you get further into your career or further into, you know, personal relationships and things like that. But I think just getting the bare bones of how do you approach building this network is something that we found really important and really wanted to have a full episode on. And I'm really glad that we finally got to talk about self-selection because we talk about that all of the time. So a couple final things. We'll definitely be posting some resources to our Instagram page about kind of those LinkedIn messages that I shared. I'm happy to share some of my own templates that I've used to achieve those competencies that we talked about earlier. And then if you are an introvert, like Alan and myself, and like our teammates are, there's a book called Quiet by Susan Cain that is really great about the power of introverts in an extroverted world. And it's particularly taking the American lens of like why America highly prizes extroverts over introverts, but like the inherent value that us introverts have too. So that's a really great book. And without further ado, we will adjourn until next time. So thank you for joining us this week and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye. Thanks for listening. This episode was made possible by our audio engineer, Jack Booth, and our growth strategist, Mikey Lulo. For more resources and inspiration on finding your purpose, check out our Instagram @PathsToPurposePod. We'll see you next time. Bye.